Spot, you are disrupting my ability to work.
Vamoose, you little varmint.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, reporting for duty.
And this week, we have a very special conundrum, justifying the Wild West on Star Trek.
Yeah, Cam, That's enough. Anyway, I think there's been a little bit of a... interesting trend, at least in some series, but this undue fascination for Westerns, and I don't know if they've always succeeded so much, but it is something that keeps popping up, and I think it makes sense, because it was that famous pitch of, you know, Wagon Train to the Stars, as right. We know, it was how the original series was described, and Gene Roddenberry, of course, cut his teeth writing Westerns on television in
the 1950s. As did a lot of the writers, and... you know, creative folk attached to Star Trek.
And you definitely see a lot of the influence of Westerns, but I think what we're focusing on here is like the very overt, very, very overt homages. Like literal people wearing cowboy hats on screen.
No subtlety whatsoever.
Yeah. Which, I know that this is kind of, I guess, topical because I think Westerns, they're obviously at their peak in like the 50s, you know.
Right. 40s and 50s, yeah.
Yeah, and they've definitely... had their peaks and valleys over the years, you know. And I think, I don't know, for the last few years here or there, but, you know, I think a renewed interest compared with where we were in, say, the 1980s or the late 90s. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be like Westerns were just did not work at the box office at all. I mean, you'd have the odd one like Dances with the Wolves or Unforgiven, which we may talk about later. But in the last few years, we've had a couple that have actually done remarkably well. There was Django Unchained.
Yeah.
And then also the Coen Brothers' True Grit, a remake, which made both a lot of money. Weirdly, Hateful Eight didn't do that well.
Yeah, that's a topic for another podcast. Yeah. But I'll just say this. I was more of a fan of Hateful Eight than I was Django Unchained.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, between those two, I'm sorry, listeners, we're going to digress for just a split second. But between those two, what do you think is more of a prototypical Western? It's Quentin Tarantino.
Well, Django Unchained.
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting that they've had a little bit of a resurgence in popularity. You and I, just the other week, we went and saw the new Magnificent Seven.
Right.
I think the reviews are a little mixed on that, but you and I came out of that quite entertained.
It was funny to me, the reactions to Magnificent Seven was a lot of people really, like, you know, pulling their apron strings and getting really upset because of the fact that, you know, they were remaking the great 1960 Western starring Yul Brynner, the John Sturges movie, but... there was also three sequels to that movie, and each one got worse and worse and worse. There was a TV series that wasn't very good. Plus, that movie, the 1961, was a loose remake of Seven Samurai. So, to me, the Magnificent Seven brand was well-tarnished before this came along, and I thought this was a fun movie.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I think what we want to tackle here is whether Star Trek's been able to justify its use of the Western genre. And I don't mean in that kind of, that more subtle way where we see that, you know, perhaps Deep Space Nine represents the frontier, and Quark is kind of that old-timey saloon keep, and Odo's the sheriff of town. You know, more of the very deliberate, in-your-face sort of Western episodes. Cam, what should we tackle first here?
Well, I think we should just start chronologically and just kind of talk through each of the series, how they tackled them differently.
Yeah.
So... if ever there was a cowboy in Star Trek, it's probably James T. Kirk.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with, you know, the big TOS Season 3 episode, Spectre of the Gun. Very interesting episode, I think. Very creative, and I'm going to maybe argue it's the most creative of the three we're going to talk about in this episode.
Okay.
It was written by Lee Cronin, which was a pseudonym for Gene Kuhn.
I did not know that.
Yes.
He was obviously proud of this effort that he put out there.
Well, yeah. I mean, he... had a few under the pseudonym, so yeah. This fell into Season 3, and I thought what was interesting is there was a particular memo that motivated the writing of this episode. And what do you think that memo would say?
More guns and more ladies.
No.
Why did
it was, please boost the role of Chekhov.
Oh, well, I was going to bring Chekhov up in this particular one. But just for those who haven't watched that episode in a while, of course, Enterprise crew, they transport onto a planet that they're not supposed to be on. And essentially, they find themselves in like this kind of weird Western town where the sets are only half built. It's a red sky the whole time, which is very typical look. But essentially, they're interacting with the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday and all those iconic figures from the Old West at the time. And they have a showdown to get to, and they're just trying to figure out how not to get killed against these gunslingers.
Right. And one of the interesting things I stumbled across is Ron Sobel, who plays Wyatt Earp. Very intimidating figure, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
That man is 5 years older than me.
Really?
He looks like he's 60.
Yeah, that is curious.
So, yeah, he's actually 40 years old. But what I really love about this episode is it is so artistically daring, mostly due to budget cuts, but it shows how much they could make out of nothing. Like, they just could not afford to do anything. And I feel like the mood and tone in this episode is just brilliant.
Well, there's literally 2.5 sets.
Yeah.
And they just walk across the street instantly. I think there's some creative elements into it. And I think what we can also judge is how well this treats the Western genre.
Right.
One of the questions I had here, throughout it, is like, what's kind of the sci-fi story that they're trying to tell?
Yeah.
And we really didn't get to that point until towards the very end, where we have Spock, doing his Vulcan mind meld once again, and we finally have that alien. What was that? Was it a device, a computer system, some sort of, like, guardian creature?
Well, it's the Malkoshian aliens.
Yeah,
I'm not really sure.
I couldn't quite figure out what they were supposed to be.
Yeah, I know.
Like, silicon-based?
Sure.
Sure. Okay.
All of the above, sure.
Well, the sci-fi stuff is fairly loosely inserted in there. It's really very much a Western episode where the crew is essentially inserted into the Old West.
Right, and I think what's key to sort of this episode, the way I approach it, is like, this one falls far more under like the spaghetti Western subgenre of Western, I found.
Wasn't this like pre-spaghetti Western?
No, it is actually sort of just early into the movement, and spaghetti Westerns happen in like the first half of the 60s. The first big breakthrough is in 1964. That's Sergio Leone's Fistful of Dollars.
Okay.
And then the movement continues. In 66, you have The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And so, when this is made in 1968, the spaghetti Western is well known. They didn't gain critical appreciation until really the 80s. But there would have been a fair amount of awareness to Fistful of Dollars, especially.
Okay.
And
but do you think this was overt, like, homage on the part of the writers, though?
I think so, because this episode really embraces surrealism in a way that no classic Western would ever touch with a 10-foot pole. This becomes something that's much more a property of spaghetti Westerns, where it's mostly because of the fact they didn't want to have a lot of language in their movies, just for dubbing purposes.
Yeah.
It became much more about myths and about kind of images. And so it was just speaking through kind of outlandish images more. Like, you think of, like, Tuco walking through like the desert with a pink umbrella. There's no explanation. This never happened in the Wild West, or in traditional Westerns,
right.
But it's an image. It's instantly evocative. And I feel like that's what Spectre of the Gun really does, is play in images more than language. Now, I think the one thing that sets it apart from, say, a classic spaghetti Western is Star Trek's talky, whereas spaghetti Westerns most definitely are not.
Very true. And, as I mentioned before, we have that very red sky, which is very evocative throughout this. But and I didn't explicitly explain it, just for listeners who may not recall the episode, but literally the sets are only half built because the Malkoshians are scanning their memories, and it's of what the Old West might have been like.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're essentially kind of piecing together, like, the crew's idea of the Old West. And literally the sets are just in pieces.
Right.
Which, to me, if somebody scanned my imagination, I would have four walls on a building. That's just me.
Yeah, and I don't know how intentional it is, but there's kind of like almost like a meta-commentary on the Western going on here. I don't think it was intentional, honestly. But there's so many historical inaccuracies in their representation of the West. Like, if they were really scanning memory, you know, people's memories for the history of the West, you know, the setting of the shootout, the big shootout, is like in a different location. It actually took place outside a photography business. People, you know, Kirk references that Ike Clanton died. Well, that's not true. He didn't. You know, it's like none of this makes sense. So it seems almost more inspired by the mythology created by pop culture, the Western pop culture movement.
Right.
So that becomes interesting into itself because, like, you know, you watch movies like My Darling Clementine or Gunfight at the OK Corral, and it's like it's trading in images and in beliefs of, like, the movie that was created by Hollywood, not the actual truth.
But do you think it could also be kind of a reference to how people piece their memories together in very inaccurate ways? Like, people, I've read studies where, like, people have determined that memories are very, very bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people do not have good memories at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could be a representative, almost a commentary on that. Although it could just be that the writers just didn't know what the hell they were talking about.
Maybe, but what's more interesting?
Oh, I know, exactly. Yeah. I find both those two interpretations far more interesting than just the fact that the writer screwed up.
Right. And so, like, that to me gives Spectre of the Gun a lot of depth in a way that I don't think some of the other ones we'll talk about today have.
Okay.
And that's what makes it interesting to me. I think there's a reason this episode is one you see presented so often in, you know, iconic shots. Like, season three is very hit or miss. You know, you don't see Mark of Gideon shots thrown off all over the place. But you have a moment for a screen grab from Spectre of the Gun, and people can instantly identify it. How many times have we seen that clip of, like, the crew all walking forward, like, at the big, you know, shootout moment?
Well, let's get into maybe something that I'm not quite sure works so well. Mm-hmm. What did you think of Chekhov in this episode? Because, as you said, there's a bit of a mandate from the studio to boost Chekhov's presence. How did you think he fared?
You know, it's funny. Like, I found when TOS would emphasize Chekhov stuff, it was not my favorite moments in the episode.
Okay.
It usually involves sort of, like, romance with, like, a young, you know, woman. Like, you see that in The Apple, the episode of The Apple 2, where he's kind of sneaking off with Celeste Darnell's character, and it's all about, hey, baby, you know, we're all alone, that sort of stuff. And that, to me, falls under, like, Spectre of the Gun.
Yeah. Literally, there's a scene where Chekhov's making out with a tavern girl for an extended period of time in front of his captain. I would say that probably went on for a good 90 seconds, which is a long time in terms of television. And really, just the whole thing is Chekhov comes off as really stupid and impetuous. Like, he's getting into fights with people that could kill him very easily. He's defending the honor of this fantasy woman who doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
Like, is Chekhov really that dumb? And I really don't like it when writers just make characters dumb to move the plot forward.
Right.
Like, I really wasn't a fan of the way Chekhov appeared in this particular episode.
All too often, Chekhov feels to me on the show like the teenage wish fulfillment character.
Sure.
Like, it's for the young boys, you know, teenage boys watching the show to be like, oh, that could be me making out with the hot girl. You know, I'm with the cool guys there, the cool older kids. We've all got guns around our waist.
I'm dressed like the Beatle.
Sure.
The Beatles.
Well, you know, 1960s. I'm sure at that time that was very cool.
Yeah.
So he was, I think, a total wish fulfillment character. But it's a type of character that doesn't age well. And
it seems dated, does it not?
Yes. And, like, I don't know. How do you think you would have reacted to him, say, when you were 15 or 14? Do you think you would have had the same reaction?
Yeah, because honestly, that's something that's always bugged me about, like, writing on television and film. Just characters being, like, dopey just for the sake of the plot.
Right.
And even just like that, like, I was never, like, intrigued by, like, the makeout sessions on TV. I always felt
you
like...
weren't?
Well, I was just kind of like, okay, this
What about the Vedic Brow ones?
Well, though, aside from those, but I don't know, like, I've never found the appeal in that sort of stuff. Like, I know a lot of people find it, like, titillating to a degree, and I'm just kind of like, okay, move it along here.
Right.
It's kind of... that's just maybe I'm a big stuffy grump or something.
Right. I mean, and we have to remember this was season three of the show, too, where there was a mandate to make it, you know, a little more action-packed, a little more romantic.
I wonder what the commercials were like for that episode. Was it just Chekhov making out with that woman?
You know what? I'll bet you they did emphasize that, as well as just, like, them firing guns.
Sure.
Like, that would be enough. It's Star Trek in the Old West.
We need to get hold of those old NBC promotional bits, you know, from way back in the day. I'd be intrigued how commercials have changed since then. The stuff, you know, we've had comments from listeners before about how much they like it when we play the previews for the two-parters ahead of our episode review.
Yeah.
Just because they're pretty hilarious. They're very 90s in right. their editing and voiceovers.
And also, like, so wildly not consistent with the episodes they're hyping.
Oh, yes. That is true. Oh, Cam, overall, how successful do you think Spectre of a Gun is?
I think it's actually one of the standouts from season 3 for me.
Okay.
It's an episode that I actually watched this on the 50th anniversary, and I really enjoyed revisiting it in a way I didn't enjoy some of the other season 3 episodes as much. And I really loved, you know, I was, the cast in this episode, not so much, you know, our principal cast, who we know well at this point. I mean, like, the guest stars, the actors that got to play all these folks in this Wild West town. Like, you had, like, you know, Ron Sobel as Wyatt Earp and Sam Gilman as Doc Holliday. They were standouts to me. And I was actually kind of disappointed. Like, I went into IMDb to kind of search out these guys' careers. I was really hoping to find kind of a, almost like an in-joke, like, hey, they played Wyatt Earp on an episode of, I don't know, Have Gun Will Travel at some point. Like, I was hoping for some sort of connection like that, and I didn't find anything, other than the fact they starred, you know, are featured in a lot of Western TV shows, but
right.
that would be pretty typical for most character actors at that point.
When you're going through their IMDb, did they work much after this one? Only because you definitely picture the 50s and 60s television as kind of the height of Westerns.
Yeah.
1968, I don't think TV in the 1970s is really known for a lot of Westerns.
Didn't Bonanza go quite a while, though? I think it went into the 70s.
I think it went, like, 20 years. But, yeah. You know, but beyond Bonanza,
they could play goons in cop shows.
Sure. Right.
But, I mean, I just loved, like, their faces. Like, this was a show where they really put actors who you could see walking out of, like, a John Ford Western in the cast. You know, you watch a show nowadays where it's set in the Wild West and everyone's got, like, perfect teeth and looks kind of pretty. Even, like, we, you know, in The Magnificent Seven, I believe our friend Julia commented on that walking out.
Yeah.
How everyone had perfect teeth in The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
You know, you watch Spectre of the Gun, Kirk and Spock and everything, they look very, like screen-appropriate actors, you know what I mean? Like, they look like leading men.
Yeah.
And then you have the supporting cast in Spectre of the Gun, and they look so used up, run over by life. What's the Indiana Jones saying? It's not the years, it's the mileage. These men have mileage.
I absolutely believe that. I absolutely agree with you. I think it's a very iconic-looking episode. But just storytelling-wise, like, I was never invested in the central story here because essentially, we see that Chekhov's dead.
Yeah.
Did you, for one instance, believe that Chekhov was actually, that he met his maker?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, this was the equivalent of Bones dying in Shore Leave.
Yeah.
So
to me, like, I wasn't completely invested because I knew that the crew would make it out of this situation. You're not killing off Chekhov. You're not killing off the rest of the crew. It's really a question of how do they get out of the situation? And I almost feel like the mind meld is kind of a deus ex machina. Just like, okay, well, we'll use Spock's sci-fi powers to solve the problem.
Right.
So, like, just from a storytelling angle, like, I just wasn't super invested in what was going on here.
Yeah.
But I agree. I think that the, especially characters like, who played Doc Holliday, the actor there, like, I thought that was memorable. I like the scenery and, you know, the, I guess, the mise-en-scene,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, it's successful there. Does it justify itself? Spending time on a planet for the Old West, is it a success here?
I'm going to say yes myself.
Okay.
I feel like this episode, you know, as I said, taps into surrealism in a really interesting way. And feels almost like a precursor to, like, El Topo, Jodorowsky's Western that came, like, 2 years later.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of almost feels like the beginning of a movement you'd see explored further as in, like, the 70s.
Yes.
But I don't think that's
Star
the
Trek
case.
Inspired.
But it feels kind of like a really interesting note in that whole movement.
Okay. I'm more on the fence on that. Like,
right.
I'm not giving it a thumbs down at all, but I'm not, I'll give it a thumb sideways at this point.
Yeah. I do agree with you, though, about sort of the ultimate, you know, science fiction message of the episode. I think there was a way to kind of tie that deeper in, because Westerns, like science fiction, are incredibly flexible genres where they're used to usually comment on philosophical issues
yes.
or politics of the day, you know.
What was this commenting on exactly?
That's, well, I'm going to be asking that about pretty much every episode we tackle today,
sure.
for the most part, because I think that's a big failure in Star Trek's approach to tackling the Westerns. They don't usually do it for a particular reason, more so as just like, wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we jump over to the next one, chronologically,
yeah,
a trip into not the Old West, Cam, but the Ancient West. Of course, we're talking a Fistful of Data's appearing in Season 6 of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah.
I recall you watching this back in the day, and you were texting me about it. You were not a big fan of it at the time. Have you come around on it in any way?
Eh.
Yeah, of course, for those who don't remember, essentially, Data and Geordi are experimenting on the Enterprise, and this is at the same time that Worf, Troy, and Alexander are in the holodeck in the Old West simulation there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bing, bang, boom, something goes wrong, the safeties are off, and Data keeps appearing as all the different characters in the Old West.
So, right.
Hey, Brent Spiner, he's great in this episode, I'd have to say.
Yeah, oh yeah, Brent Spiner's having a blast. I mean, how many episodes did Brent Spiner have to just kind of go nuts in?
Oh, yeah.
There's definitely a few. We'll talk about masks one day.
Well, even just seeing Data on the ship as, you know, this program is, you know, seeping into his own circuitry, and he's saying to people, I reckon. Like, it was great to see Data, the character, say, I reckon.
Yeah, like, I really appreciate all the set dressing of this episode, but this to me feels kind of like even less dangerous than Back to the Future 3.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Look, I mean, like, they have to get to the end of the program. It's kind of... Well, for me, I how do you think the aesthetics of this compare with, say, Spectre of the Gun? Because I think Spectre of the Gun far more memorable when it comes to just the look of it.
Right, well, Spectre of the Gun, to me, they didn't go into that episode saying, let's just recreate a Hollywood movie. This feels like they were like, we gotta recreate a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, and of course, this one, it's called A Fistful of Data's.
Yeah.
Is it a remake of A Fistful of Dollars, Cam?
Well, there is so much confusion going on with this episode and what it's homaging.
Yes.
Because, yes, it was Fistful of Data's is, of course, a reference to Fistful of Dollars. Its original title was going to be The Good, the Bad, and the Klingon, which, of course, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. Right from these titles, you're going, well, obviously, spaghetti westerns. And Troy's character seems to be modeled kind of on a spaghetti western trope, which is, you know, the man with no name. But actually, her name's Durango in this,
yeah,
which is actually closer to the original Django, played by Franco Nero in the 1966 movie Django. So there's a whole lot of confusion going on.
I think really it comes down to the writers just looking at the basic idea of Western,
yeah,
but not... Do you think any of them were students of the Western genre?
Definitely not. And, you know, the episode was ultimately inspired by two movies, particularly Rio Bravo from 1959 and Shane.
Right.
And Patrick Stewart directed this episode, and, you know, he said he watched a lot of classic Hollywood Westerns to get in the mindset for this episode, which right there, boom, Patrick Stewart sort of generation, he's going classic Hollywood. He's not going to kind of the edgier 60s, mid to late 60s stuff.
He was not looking at Shanghai Noon either and, you know, trying to emulate that.
No. And so, you know, this episode rips whole story elements out of Rio Bravo. You know, the whole idea of, you know, they have this criminal in the jail. His family member comes to negotiate. It's his father in Fistful of Data's. In Rio Bravo, it's his brother.
It's kind of tough because for those of you who have not seen Rio Bravo,
yeah,
it's an amazing movie. Is it like
it is?
It's one of the I put in like top 100. You know,
yeah,
it's an exceptional film.
Yeah,
very well done. I don't know what the writers were thinking if they're trying to like do like almost like a recreation of that. Like that's they're almost like painting themselves into a really tight corner there.
Are you saying that Alexander is no Dean Martin?
Saddle up, father.
I would have loved if he'd been drunk half the episode. That would have been amazing.
Yes. But look, is this a... Okay. Writers wanted to have a lighter episode, obviously.
Yeah.
They wanted to have fun. Did you think that this is a fun jump into the Old West? Or the Ancient West, I should say, as it was described in this episode?
I think it has its moments.
Yeah.
There is an issue, and this is the film geek in me that really kind of finds the episode more problematic than I think any regular viewer would. Is I'm sitting there and I know it was, you know, you can just tell it's been pretty much ripped out of Rio Bravo, a very simplified version of that.
Yeah.
And the Durango character, they originally wanted Maureen Sirtis to play a saloon girl, which would have been even more in keeping with Rio Bravo.
I'm glad that she wasn't playing a saloon girl.
This is way more fun.
Yeah. What I said before is like they painted themselves into a corner by doing almost like a direct remake of Rio Bravo.
Yeah.
The thing they really should have done is just not make it such an overt remake. Like they could take that same premise, have it take place on the Enterprise with somebody in the brig. That would have been far more effective, I think.
Because Rio Bravo has some really like political baggage that goes along with it. Because Howard Hawks made that movie as a response to High Noon.
Which is another great film.
Great film, but he viewed it as very un-American.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, the sheriff who's going around the town asking everyone to come together to save the town from outlaws. And no one will help him. Turns out to be just the one man alone. And Howard Hawks and John Wayne were outraged by this. And they said that's so un-American that these people wouldn't come together to save their community. You know, everyone's cowards.
Yeah.
And so Rio Bravo has a lot of weight to it that Star Trek doesn't even attempt to tackle. Like, I think you could have made a parallel about the idea of Starfleet sticking together.
But I even like the idea because I think it goes beyond just un-American that they're making accusations of. I think they're even calling it, like, communist.
Sure.
To a degree. I think that was kind of a lot of the political baggage there. Mm-hmm. You go into, you know, the world of Star Trek, which has a lot of these socialist ideals. I think there's just so much more room for them to kind of mine, you know, just out of kind of the political stuff going on there.
And do you think they did anything like
that? No, nothing at all. Yeah. I think this is mostly them just trying to have a little fun.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, look, we can give Brent Spiner anything to do.
Yeah.
He's literally, like, flipping tricorders in his hand and, like, slamming it down in his holster as if it was a six-shooter, you know? Like, that's fun to do. Spiner going country voice, that's fun to do. But is it an engaging Western story for you, Cam?
It's okay. Yeah. I think I commented, maybe it was on the podcast, where I said, like, it feels almost like a remake of, like, a B-Western. Like, and this is definitely in the mold of more the classic Hollywood Western that started in 1939 with Stagecoach. The ones going forward, it's definitely trying to homage sort of that sort of type of storytelling, but it doesn't do it very well. Like, it's almost like remaking a B-movie version of that, like one of the cheapies cranked out versus one of the prestige pictures.
Well, what was that 90s Western film with, like, Drew Barrymore and...
That was Bad Girls.
Bad Girls, yes.
1995.
Like,
or was it 93, maybe? 93.
Maybe 93. Do you think this is a remake of Bad Girls?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do now.
That's why, you know, you needed Durango Troy in there.
Sure.
I was just looking at the aesthetic of it. The whole, like, Western backlot, it looks very 1990s.
Yes.
Like, this, like, I think Spectre of a Gun looks a little more ageless. Like, it's very, like, we get it. You're on kind of a cheap soundstage, but it has a kind of iconic look to it that it's going to age much better than what this is. I'm watching, and I should have brought this up at the top, but right now I'm watching the new HBO series Westworld, which is very kind of a sci-fi take on the West, really.
Right.
And it's interesting how they're playing with those ideas of sci-fi and mixing it very well with the Western genre in a very effective way. And to me, I think that's going to age far better, you know, it'll seem a little bit more timeless than an episode like A Fistful of Datas does.
Sure.
I'd hope it's more similar to how, I think Spectre of a Gun seems more timeless than A Fistful of Datas. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's actually, you know, you bring up Westworld and think of the original movie Westworld.
Yeah.
It's kind of curious they didn't maybe try and take advantage of that premise with this episode.
Yeah, that would have been
That's something we wouldn't have seen before, is kind of the idea of a Western fantasy world coming alive on Star Trek. They could do their own kind of twist on that idea.
And would have gone in there for best recreation episodes.
Of
best
course.
Recreation planet, or what are they? Fantasy planets? What do we call them, Cam?
Pleasure planets?
Pleasure planets, yes. Yeah. Pleasure planet where you go to the Old West and it's all robots.
Yeah.
It could have been a Simpsons homage as well.
Yeah, this to me just feels like an episode where they came up with, hey, let's just do TNG Goes to the Wild West, Ancient West, in a holodeck, and that was kind of the beginning and end. It was, okay, I just rip out the story from Rio Bravo, and, you know, it's just kind of a lark. Like, there's nothing in this episode that really delivers anything interesting. It's cute, I would say.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, you're cutting back with all the stuff with, you know, Data's, you know, computer interfering with the Enterprise, and it's just like, am I really invested in the drama of this?
I was far more interested in what was going on in the Enterprise than what was going on in Deadwood.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I might have to disagree there.
Okay.
I think the Wild West stuff, I was like, well, at least this is different.
Okay.
But you never feel any danger.
No, but I... Did you feel danger in the Old West? I mean, look, the safeties are always off. I felt that the crew was in more danger in Fistful of Datas in the holodeck than they were in Spectre of the Gun. What did you feel?
No, to me, like, the atmosphere of Spectre of the Gun feels more foreboding.
Okay.
And just kind of creepy.
Yeah.
So, like, I sense danger out of that.
See, when you have a kid in a very dangerous situation, Alexander's literally kidnapped at a certain point. You know?
And the audience cheers.
But it, to me, it adds maybe more investment. As soon as I see that Chekhov's quote-unquote dead, I'm just like, well, I know he's not really dead.
Right.
You know, if, let's say, Worf was shot at the very beginning of this episode and Troy pronounced him dead, I'd be like, then I would have checked out even more. But, you know, okay. Well, just a couple notes that I want to get off on this one here. I find it somewhat hard to believe that there'd be, like, a Mexican, you know, Baccaro in Deadwood, North Dakota. That's a bit of a hike. You know, I think they're kind of mixing their Westerns there.
Well, there was a lot of Mexicans in, especially they were more pronounced in spaghetti Westerns.
Yeah, but...
So they're mixing their homages a bit, I think, there.
They're certainly... North Dakota's a long way from Mexico. That's all. And the other thing is, I do like the fact that Barclay wrote some of this, and Worf had to have a discussion with Barclay afterwards, because very kind of sexualized women appearing throughout this.
Yeah, I mean, there are some laughs in this episode. I think that's what makes it work, is some of the minor moments of amusement. But, I mean, how invested were you in, let's be honest, we're talking circles around all the Western aspects and all that sort of thing. That's not what this episode's about. It's about Worf bonding with Alexander. How did you feel this episode delivered on that front?
Better than a typical Worf-Alexander bonding episode.
Right. That doesn't say anything.
No, honestly, I just, at the very beginning where, like, you could tell Worf was trying to give himself work to do.
Yeah.
He did not want to spend time with Alexander. He did not want, like, isn't that kind of a horrible, it says a lot about Worf as a father. Like, I don't think people give Worf a bad enough time about this fact, but Worf was not a good father figure.
No.
Not at all. Like, he was kind of that, he sent Alexander off to live with his parents. At a certain point, Worf had no idea that his son even joined the Imperial Guard to like fight in the Dominion War. Worf is not a good pops. Would you say that?
Yeah, it's true. Very, very true. And, you know, obviously this episode can't be held responsible for all the baggage that comes later. But there is something kind of almost insulting now when you see this episode and it ends with, like, you know, I love you, Father. Can we go back? And then, you know, ends with Worf making finger guns in the mirror with a cowboy hat. And I'm like, you know, I have a hard time picturing the Worf from Deep Space Nine engaging in this adventure.
I agree. although, you know what? Okay. I love that he's wearing a cowboy hat throughout this episode. And one of his first lines when he arrived on Deep Space Nine was when Kira came out of the hall suite in her medieval garb.
Yeah.
And he says to her, nice hat. Like, I wish somebody said that to Worf's point during this episode. So, Cam, would you say that this justified itself as a very overt Western when it comes to Star Trek?
No. It's weird because I can kind of justify it in my head as like a watchable holodeck episode.
Okay.
Like, the bar is so low for holodeck episodes. Like, I don't feel this is, by any stretch, the worst offender.
Yeah.
It's one that I'm like, yeah, it's kind of dumb and goofy and kind of that Back to the Future 3 is way better. But in that sort of harmless Western kind of way.
There's no ZZ Top in A Fistful of Data's.
That's why it fails.
Yeah.
But, you know, and you get that fun laugh at the end with Brent Spiner as, like, the saloon girl running up and kissing Worf. You know, like, those
that's
are the...
my cosplay for next year's Las Vegas Star Trek convention.
So, like, those are the moments that fans can enjoy. And you yourself have the action figure of Worf dressed as a cowboy.
I bought that as a joke.
Sure you did.
Mostly because, is that the only Alexander figure?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so I actually own a cowboy. A cowboy Alexander was, like, the mini accessory that came with Worf as well. So I have the only Alexander figure in existence as well.
There you go. So, like, yes, I think this episode, I think it's delivered enough for fans that I can kind of get behind it.
Okay.
But it's not one that is anywhere near my favorite, and I don't think it's as good as Spectre of the Gun.
Yeah.
And not as interesting as Spectre of the Gun.
If I was on the fence, if I was giving Spectre of a Gun a thumb sideways, this is below Spectre of the Gun for me, so I don't think it's, I don't think it's a very effective, you know, Western episode. So, I'll go so far as to give it a thumbs down. There's enough moments that I liked in this that I thought was watchable.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to end up on my top 75 list of Next Generation, though.
Do you think this episode, do you think fans, you know, who have watched this episode will gain any more enjoyment out of it by watching Rio Bravo and then watching this episode?
No, because I think they gain less enjoyment out of it knowing that how great Rio Bravo is.
Yeah, it's true.
So,
and in just as a note, there is a fun little shot of Alexander peering out under saloon doors. And that was taken from the movie Shane.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Well, Kim, why don't we jump over to North Star from Enterprise? And I know maybe a lot of you guys haven't necessarily watched this episode.
What?
But I would say keep tuning in for this one, because this is also a different take. We're looking at different eras of Westerns as well. And I think you alluded to it at the start, but this one is more of a take similar kind of into the stylization of, say, 90s Westerns.
Sort of the revisionist Western, deconstructing the West sort of movement. It starts begins in kind of late 50s. I think John Ford kind of kicks it off with Shan Autumn officially. But then you get like Little Big Man in 1970 and moves into the 80s, 90s.
I've never seen Little Big Man.
Very good movie. It's actually, if you watch it, you'll be honestly shocked at how close it is to Forrest Gump.
Oh, okay.
Like, it is. Really? Yes, it is the Western version of Forrest Gump.
We need a Star Trek Forrest Gump episode at a certain point. It'll be a time travel episode where, like, there's just one character who happens to be in all the pivotal moments throughout Star Trek lore.
Has that ever happened?
No.
No, that's kind of surprising.
I'm pitching it to you, Brian Fuller, right now. My Forrest Gump Star Trek episode.
Is the Traveler Forrest Gump?
That'd be amazing, yes. He can take different shapes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Score.
Why did we not include the Traveler in our characters that need to come back for Star Trek Discovery?
Didn't we briefly mention him?
I don't think so.
Okay, okay. Well, anyways, North Star. This is the crew of the NX-01. They're in the middle of the Delphic Expanse, far from home. Mm-hmm. And they come across a planet filled by humans and another alien race. And they're all dressed in cowboy hats and cowboy garb, living in Old West towns. It's some remote planet. It's very odd, Cam.
It's the alternate Earth concept that the original series pounded into the ground.
Yes.
And Enterprise brought it back.
And eventually we find out that the Skagerrans, or Skagerrans?
Skagerrans, yeah.
Skagerrans had kidnapped a whole bunch of people from an Old West town and brought them over as laborers, and then the humans revolted and just turned this planet into very much like their own home.
Right.
You know, so they obviously brought revolvers with them, or did they build their own foundry to build revolvers? There's a lot of like stuff that I didn't quite grasp, but how they were able to recreate a planet of Old West towns.
That is an excellent point, because if you're an alien kidnapping people, you probably don't want them bringing firearms.
Yes. Maybe that's why the humans were able to overpower the Skagerrans, after landing on this planet.
Because I feel like the odds of the Skagerrans having their own firearms in the same style of the Wild West is very unlikely.
It's true, it's true.
Yeah.
You know.
Skagerrans, maybe not the brightest alien race.
Well, no, that's what the humans tried to do, because we know that they were not... The Skagerrans were, like, second class. And right. I think there's a lot of... to me, it's very overt, but, like, how it's kind of a story of slavery, which is very timely with the whole Old West genre. Because what we think of as the Old West comes about after, you know, the American Civil War, in which that was fought over slavery. Mm-hmm. You have all these free people, but here the Skagerrans are second-class citizens. They're not even allowed to be educated.
Right.
To me, this is a very Star Trek-y episode, just in themes, of course. I think it may be the Star Trek-iest of all the episodes that we're talking about this for this particular
It's the one with the, transmissions. You know, we talked at the top about how the Western was often used like science fiction to tackle actual, you know, historical moments or politics of the day, etc. And this episode definitely does that. Although Brian Bragg actually said it was more of a parallel for the Aboriginals.
Okay.
And when, you know, the settlement to the West.
I think that makes
sense. It also works. Yeah, I think both parallels work, and I think that's what makes this episode at least interesting in that front.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, I interpret it in one way, mm-hmm. and I actually think the way that he's saying it actually makes more sense now that I think about it, but I definitely saw that it was, like, there's very much an allegorical story going on here.
Yeah.
Do you think it was a more effective parallel about Aboriginal people than, say, Journey's End from Star Trek The Next Generation?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. Which featured the Traveler?
It's funny, with the writing of this episode, David Goodman wrote it, and when he had the idea, you know, he was actually pitching it as a medieval episode, and it was going to be set in medieval times. And Braga was like, no, do it in the Wild West.
Okay. And but Braga didn't really have a lot of success with his previous go at it. Of course, I don't think we mentioned it. He wrote A Fistful of Davis.
Co-wrote, yeah, with Robert Hewitt Wolfe. But yes, maybe he was like, you know what? I didn't do it great the first time. Let's see if we can nail it the second.
Okay. I'll jump ahead just a little bit, but do you think this is a more effective episode than A Fistful of Datas?
I think it works better, yes. Yeah. The question is, do you think it's as enjoyable?
Well, okay, because this is, I would say Fistful of Datas is a funner episode.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, and this is, I think there's some issues with the direction. I never really felt a sense of tension throughout mm-hmm. this episode.
No.
You know, but I like this episode more than A Fistful of Datas, and I thought that it was using the Western to a far better effect than A Fistful of Datas.
Yeah, and, you know, David Goodman said it was heavily inspired by The Unforgiven, right. The Clint Eastwood Best Picture winner.
Is that why Tripp spent half the episode trying to build a house that really sucked?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it had a shot, actually, from that of a guy in a coffin standing up against the wall, so they did take moments from that. But he said he wanted it to be gritty and realistic. And,
Far as, like, grittiness and Star Trek goes, they don't always go together. I guess this is gritty for Star Trek.
Yeah.
Really, you literally have, like, this sheriff's deputy taking, like, a meat cleaver and trying to smash Archer in the face with it.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty gritty.
Sure. And the big fight in the hayloft.
That was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like how Archer wins it. Again, Archer, another episode in which Archer gets punched in the face quite a bit.
Of course.
But Archer is able to win the fight because the guy tries to hack him with a meat cleaver and it gets stuck in a wall, so Archer just punches him really hard in the face.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I got a laugh out of that. Like, that was at least amusing.
To me, where this episode doesn't quite understand Unforgiven is the fact that Unforgiven is about, like, how awful violence is.
Yes.
Whereas this has, like, a prolonged shootout, the big fist fight, and also, like, Unforgiven really sold the fact that, like, there were no heroes.
Yes.
There are heroes in this story.
Archer is the man.
Yes.
You know, he brings about education for these second-class citizens. He's not really following the Prime Directive. Not that one existed at this point, but...
Yeah, how does the Prime Directive work if they're kidnapped from Earth?
They are humans.
Yeah.
You know, and remember Archer said, hey, don't worry, when we get back to Earth, we're going to tell everybody to come back to the Delphic Expanse. Did anything ever happen with that?
I feel like it's the same as, like, in the original series when Kirk's like, don't worry, we're going to check up on you. Kind of like Khan. When they left him on SETI Alpha.
That didn't happen.
Yeah, don't worry, we'll be back.
No. I do think that this was a decent episode. Like, the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. Like, because mm-hmm. this is the point where I'd stopped watching Enterprise, like, during its first run, but I'd go and jump in, like, tune in, channel flip in, just see what they're up to. And I remember I channel flipped onto this particular episode back in the day. I was like, yeah, I'm not going back to Enterprise, sorry.
I think this episode could have been far worse than it is. I think it's a decent episode. Like, I appreciate that, you know, unlike Fistful of Datas, it has a science fiction premise it wants to use.
Yeah.
You know, so does Spectre of the Gun. It's just not done very well. It's left kind of till the third act, or I guess fifth act in TV speak, but, you know,
well, what do you mean by that?
Sort of the idea of the mind over matter aspect of Spectre of the Gun.
I thought you were talking about the sci-fi. Because I think the sci-fi story here in Enterprise is introduced, like, fairly early
on. No, I'm saying it works here because it's actually set up from the start, whereas Spectre of the Gun, it was like a fifth act or fourth act reveal or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So overall, like, I'll give this one the thumbs up, and it's a very hesitant thumbs up.
Right.
If I have to rank these three episodes, I think this was the most successful one in justifying itself as a Western, but guess what? I know you're going to disagree, which is fine, but I think that Spectre of a Gun has, I think the direction of it was far superior than this. I don't think the direction of North Star was very good.
You expected me to disagree with this?
I know, my rankings.
Oh, okay.
Like,
okay.
I like this as an episode of Star Trek and as a throwback to Westerns, more so than I did Spectre of a Gun or Fistful of Datas.
I think my problem with North Star comes from the fact that while I appreciate its message, and, you know, Goodman said he very much wanted to do one kind of that was a tribute to his favorite episodes, like Piece of the Action and Patterns of Force.
Sure, yeah.
You know, Star Trek in sort of a historical timeline kind of moment, famous historical moment. I'm not invested in in sort of the new characters in this story the way I am in those episodes, or in say Fistful of, or well, yeah, I mean to a certain degree Fistful of Data's and also Spectre of the Gun. Like, there's a school teacher in this. I mean, the actress is fine. I just don't find any of the characters really pop in this episode.
What about James Parks as the sheriff's deputy, the evil sheriff's deputy?
He's fine.
Yeah, I like James Parks as an actor. Like, I don't think there's much, you know, when you're trying to look at his motivation, I can't really understand where he's coming from so much. But
right.
I think as far as the antagonists go, he was all right.
But would you say there's any of the new characters in this episode are very iconic?
No.
Yeah, and to me, that's where it kind of falls a little lesser than the other two.
Well, even just
in that regard.
Yeah, the iconic imagery of, say, Spectre of a Gun, and especially Fistful of Data's, which, like all you need to see is Data in any outfit that he was wearing in that episode,
yeah.
And you know which episode you're talking about.
Or Troy with, like, our feet up on the desk.
Yeah, or like, Worf in a cowboy's hat, you know. Is there much that's very visually memorable about North Star?
No, I would say the most you get is Scott Bakula in his outfit, and he sort of has the Clint Eastwood Unforgiven hat.
Yeah.
I would say like that. Like, nothing to do with Tripp or T'Pol to me. We haven't even mentioned them in regards to this episode.
No, here's my mention. For some reason, Tripp has a harmonica.
Yeah.
He just carries it around with him and trades it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for Tripp to play harmonica in episodes preceding this one now.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of appreciated his joke about how he'd seen all the John Ford westerns, which is bullshit, because if you see how many westerns that John Ford made, it's an insane catalog.
Yes.
Many lost.
Well, the other thing is, where exactly did the crew get their western outfits from?
That's one of those things I don't question. I'm sure they just, you know, got them off the replicator.
They don't have replicators.
That is an excellent point. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Boom. Mind blown.
But that's just it. Like, were they carrying around, like, different, like, period garb, you know, for, like, their rec days on board the ship, you know, if they're doing plays or what?
Is there a tailor on Enterprise? Because you would need one, I would think.
Oh, you know, that could be it. You know, maybe there was a tailor on Enterprise.
Oh.
Okay.
We may have something here.
Maybe Chef had to do double duty. Maybe he had to cook and was a tailor.
Who did haircuts?
Chef. This is a secret ingredient.
I feel like there's a culture on Enterprise we never really got to learn about, which is who does all these sort of manual jobs.
Yeah, they kind of touched upon it on the D, you know, with Mr. Mott.
Yeah.
You know, but like, what about like the very militarized, more, the ships that did not have civilians on it? Like, Voyager had, I guess, Neelix. I guess Enterprise had Chef. But beyond that, there's a lot of these. I don't picture an enlisted, you know, guy going around and cutting people's hair on the ship.
Right. So. And wouldn't that just be, like, a fun moment in the show? Just to have a scene of a character, like, getting up from a haircut and, you know, doing something? Like, it just kind of adds an inner life to the characters and their world.
Brian Fuller, we're giving you gold this evening. Please, please, take all you wish. You have our permission.
Haircuts and the Traveler.
Yes. Okay, well, okay, how would you rank the episodes as we have them right now, Cam?
I think I would rank them. Spectre of the Gun for me is an easy number one.
Okay.
When it comes to number two, I'm really torn because I think I prefer North Star as a work of, like, hour-long dramatic television. But I feel like Fistful of Data is the one I kind of have to side a little more with.
Okay.
Because it is iconic, and as much as I have issues with its storytelling, I can't discount the direction in regards to images because fans have been going nuts over the imagery of this episode for, like, 25, almost 30 years.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, I think North Star is the least iconic out of the three, and that's regardless of the fact that Enterprise is the lowest-rated television series, but I do agree with that.
But it's not even like North Star, within the canon of Enterprise episodes, is one that fans really mention much.
Yeah.
Like, I had almost forgotten this episode even existed when you named it for us to talk about in our presentation in Vegas. I was like, North Star? And rewatching, I was like, how the hell did I ever forget about this episode? It seems, especially like when it lands smack dab into season three, which is like, you know, such a great season.
Yeah, it's in the middle of the Zindi arc. It's a little jarring that you have something like this on there. So.
But I think it's fine. Like, I don't dislike North Star in any way, shape, or form. I just don't think it's that inspired.
Well, let me throw this out to you. Would you like to see a very overt Western retelling or episode in Star Trek Discovery at a certain point, if it makes sense within the context of the series? Is that something you're interested in, is these more Western sort of themed episodes?
It's not at the top of my list. I'd be okay if they did. If they could find sort of another like Western movement that they want to tackle, kind of like the three we've talked about today, all tackle different elements of the Western filmmaking. If they could find a new way to do it, okay. I would be more interested to see them do maybe like a World War II adventure, sure. Or the medieval stories.
We got space Nazis, Cam. Don't forget that.
True. Yeah. Or the medieval, you know, age that keeps getting passed over for first this episode and also First Contact.
I was going to bring up First Contact was originally called Star Trek Renaissance.
Yeah,
which I think is an amazing name. Can we get J.J. Abrams to name that his fourth film Star Trek Renaissance?
We can get Chris Hemsworth as, like, the Black Knight.
I want him in, like, medieval tights, you know. really, he has to do kind of a Robin Hood Men in Tights film, essentially.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, look, I'm not opposed to a Western episode of Discovery, but I feel like there's other things to tackle. Like, what about a musical episode? That's never happened.
I'm genuinely surprised that we haven't had a Star Trek musical
episode. We kind of did, I guess, with His Way. From Deep Space Nine, but it's not a true musical.
No, because it's all like pre-existing songs, you know, that you, but the thing that I do understand though is, if you look at Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I remember I made you watch that musical episode of Buffy, did I not?
No, you didn't.
Okay, I'm thinking of something else you can tell that took a long time to make, like write all the music as well as just produce the episode. There's actors had to learn a lot of choreography. I think you could easily do a sci-fi musical episode, but it better be good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think that would actually be a far more interesting artistic opportunity for Star Trek to take. I hope Discovery isn't about going back to the hits of the past.
Yeah.
Because we saw, you know, with Enterprise, you know, look, this episode is what it is, the North Star, but we saw what happened when they tried to revisit the, you know, Nazis. In the Nazi aliens. And that was just terrible.
Yeah.
So I would prefer that, you know, especially if it's been a genre that was tackled really well by a previous Star Trek episode, figure out something else to do. Something else we can all have iconic imagery with, you know, that lasts us the next 20, 30 years.
Or even just do, like I kind of proposed with that whole Rio Bravo idea, take kind of an idea, like rip off the Magnificent Seven and just do your own version of that, but in sci-fi. And you brought it up during our How Film Has Influenced Star Trek. It may be in the title, Magnificent Ferengi, but that's not really the same premise as Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, I know.
So, all right, sir.
Okay, well, before we sign off, we have an email that came in from Clark German. He was writing in about our episode we did last week about characters we'd like to see on Discovery. And his subject heading was, Characters We Hope to See in Disco.
I like how they're calling it Disco as opposed to what I call it, Star Trek Discovery, as STD. The initials. Look it up, people.
So here's the email. It says, Listen, I have kids, small kids, so I only got partway through the episode. So forgive me if you mention this character later on, but I really was mentally screaming it out, so I thought I would scream at you guys. How about Finnegan from the TOS episode Shore Leave? He was an upperclassman when Kirk was entering the academy. He was fun, reckless, and a bit of a jerk. A good midshipman character to stir the pot in scenes. Yours in Trek, Clark. Now, I remember, I think in the later in the episode, we did reference Finnegan. However, I gotta give Clark points because we did not cite him as an example of a character we would like to have back.
Yeah, and in all fairness, Finnegan did reappear in Star Trek Beyond very briefly as played by Greg Grunberg, although he was unnamed.
And unrecognizable as Finnegan.
And did not have an accent, an Irish accent.
And no wacky music played when he showed up on screen.
Finnegan in Discovery, I don't think that the Finnegan that we saw on Shore Leave is actually the real Finnegan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean that, like, actually representative of his personality. It was a creation of James Kirk's imagination, how he remembered Finnegan, of course. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if Finnegan did appear again, he would be a very different character than what we saw in Shore Leave. He could be far more professional. He just, for whatever reason, picked on Kirk. And, you know, that's why Kirk had the urge to just beat him up.
Yeah, I would be down for seeing like sort of the redemption of Finnegan.
Yeah.
I don't think Greg Grunberg did it because I don't think anyone even realizes that was Finnegan.
No.
It's one of those things you have to check the credits to even figure out. But I mean, I think it's a fun idea. And, you know, you talked about like Arne Darvin. You know, there's another kind of small, kind of rascally character you could maybe do something interesting with. I think Finnegan falls in that same sort of camp. I mean, he's obviously a fun joke character with fans, but I don't see any reason why you couldn't add some depth to him.
The only thing is, if he was going to reappear, there has to be a fight sequence that he's involved with. Otherwise, it would just be a waste.
Do you have to do it, I think?
I think you do.
Yeah.
Greg Grunberg didn't do it, and that was a waste, I have to say.
Right. Now, we talked a lot about Finnegan in our Irish Stereotypes episode. if you're going to bring Finnegan into Discovery, what about the cartoonish Irish accent?
That's why I'm totally happy with the fact that, look, that's not the real Finnegan, though.
Sure.
It's just Kirk's imagination, you know, materialized.
So you're saying that wasn't his voice?
Yeah, it's probably not his voice. You just get a regular Irish actor, do a regular voice, and maybe he seems a little pompous, or maybe he picks on, you know, some of the junior officers a little bit. But beyond that, he could be a total pro that Kirk just did not get along with.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I would totally be down for that. I always think it's fun to take a character that the audiences view in one specific way and then add a twist to them.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, if you're going to set Discovery where you are, it gives you the opportunity to kind of expand characters that maybe audiences would never expect to see expand in interesting ways.
Yeah.
So I think that would be a lot of fun and add to kind of the richness of the overall universe. So, yeah, I think that's awesome. And thanks, Clark, for sending that email, and very much appreciate it.
And hopefully you'll get to listen to the rest of that episode. It was a fun episode.
It was.
So if you haven't listened to it yet, go back to last week's episode about what Star Trek characters we'd like to see return in Star Trek Discovery.
That's right.
Or Disco.
Star Trek Disco. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We're getting spooky, Cameron. We're going to take a look at how Star Trek deals with the supernatural. Of course, line up close to Halloween, and we've done Halloween episodes in the past, and I think this is kind of looking at a different angle here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because, you know, Star Trek is so scientific. Does that work with the paranormal?
That's what you'll have to tune in and find out
right
next week.
Should be a lot of fun. I'm very much looking forward to this one.
Yes.
We're talking about some great, great episodes.
I know some of your personal favorites.
Oh, yes. So you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Virgil Earp, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in North Star.
Okay, so until next time, for our spooky Halloween episode, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.